We're about to talk to Romina Baccia. She's an economist and research coordinator for the Rowe Institute for Economic Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation. And Romina Baccia, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me on.
So, first of all, I think most of America had probably never even heard this word before, sequestration. You know, I think many people have to go to their dictionaries and see if the word even exists or if it was invented by Congress. but at this point, I think most of America is probably fairly frustrated by it. They don't seem to blame the president. The president seems to blame Congress. And it's very murky. What people do know is that these $85 billion in spending cuts are frightening for a lot of people and their well-being.
Sequestration is certainly a blunt instrument to cut spending, and it's definitely indicative of Washington dysfunction on the budget. It doesn't actually reduce real spending. Federal spending continues growing. The problem is that sequestration takes an across-the-board spending cut in an area of the budget that is actually not growing as much. The real problem is in mandatory spending, and that are the entitlement programs like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, welfare. Those are growing out of control, and they continue to grow, and that's where we need to make the reforms and budget cuts. Sequestration cuts a lot of other programs, takes an across-the-board approach. It's not deliberate, so I don't think anybody likes sequestration. The problem is that we are on a fiscal collision course, and we need to cut spending somewhere.
So let's talk about the collision course. I mean, when we mention things like Social Security, let's take them one at a time for a moment. There are many people who argue that that Social Security is not even part of the problem, that if that the problem has been the rating of its trust fund, the problem has been the given the way the world's economy goes, that the stopping the Social Security contributions at too low a point in terms of salary, in terms of salary salaries, that really isn't part of the problem, and we're putting it on the table, and that's as something that shouldn't be affecting this budget discussion at all.
Social Security has not been on the table in any of these budget discussions, but it absolutely needs to be. We spend more on Social Security in a given year than on any other government program. We spend more on Social Security than we do on national defense. And Social Security, the big problem we face is that we have an aging population. We have a slower growth in the population and in the young people that are taking the jobs and paying the contributions that are paying current benefits for Social Security recipients. And Americans are living longer. Some of these are good news, like living longer. Others, like our population is getting older, there are fewer workers to every beneficiary. That's bad news. And so the program is unaffordable as it is currently structured, but there are reforms that can be made to make sure that Social Security acts as a social safety net for those seniors who need the benefits the most. But let's start looking at, for example, does Warren Buffett really need a Social Security check? First of all, we cannot afford it. Second of all, he really doesn't need that money. So there's changes like that where we start looking at targeting benefits to those seniors who need them the most, while asking those who can do without to make their contribution to reducing our spending and our debt in the future, because we're looking at a doomsday scenario if we don't control the growth in federal spending.
Well, what about the arguments that some would make? I agree with you completely. The Warren Buffetts of the world do not need Social Security, nor should they get it. And I won't argue with that at all. But many would say that when it comes to Social Security, in terms of our debt, that we, A, what has to happen is we have to raise the salary level where contributions would be put into it. If it was up to $130,000 a year, some economists, and you may disagree, would argue that this would take care of the problem if for the next 40 years. And that others are also arguing that part of the problem is our rating of the Social Security Trust Fund to pay for other parts of our government that has depleted the money that we have for our seniors, and that we've created this kind of false dichotomy, this false line between generations.
There is no money in the Social Security Trust Fund. it's another measure of our government debt. As soon as the money came into Social Security at the time during which there was a surplus, when Social Security started, there were 16 workers paying into Social Security for every beneficiary. Today, there's 2.3 workers for every beneficiary. So the fundamentals of how the program is financed have changed. And Congress immediately spent the money that came into Social Security. They recorded it as an IOU, as a debt in the trust fund, but the money is gone. So what we need to look at is, yes, it is Congress did not hold its promise there. They spent all the money. There is no assets in the Social Security trust fund. But looking forward, are we able to pay promised benefits, and what is it going to take to do that? And this idea of raising the payroll tax even higher than it already is, that affects workers directly. That affects businesses who are trying to hire workers, because let's remember that the Social Security tax is paid half by the employer and half by the employee. And when you raise that tax, you make it more expensive for businesses to hire employees. You make it more expensive for workers to take jobs. And so their salaries will be lower. They will pay higher taxes. That means a slower economy and a less job creation. And that doesn't seem like a good idea for anyone, especially in an economy where we find ourselves today with still over 12 million Americans out of work.
Well, two things, and then I want to move on to the other parts of where you think, how you think we should handle this sequestration issue. And just one more question on Social Security here. I guess what I was arguing was that some people argue that you shouldn't, not raising the number, but broadening the number of people who pay into Social Security, so it takes care of the future, the next 30 years, the next 40 years. And B, so are we saying then that because the federal government usurped the money from Social Security, that our seniors now and our seniors in the future should have to pay for that? They should have their benefits gone because there was a mistake made? That that's the only solution is to cut?
No, that's not what I'm saying at all. What I'm saying is that today's workers are paying benefits to today's seniors. And they're paying benefits even for seniors who don't need the benefits. And if you look at who pays the largest share of the payroll tax, it's actually low-income and middle-income workers. Like you said, because it phases out at a certain income level. And that is fundamentally unfair, that we're making it harder for these people to put aside a nest egg, put aside money so they can send their kids to college and better themselves and better their families by raising the payroll tax so we can pay Social Security benefits to seniors that don't even need it. So we need to look at Social Security reform, and we can argue about what the best policies would be. But I think one thing is clear, which is that the system as it's currently structured cannot continue going at this rate. So we do need to make reforms, and that has not been part of any of the budget discussions. And sequestration certainly does not touch Social Security at all. And this is why sequestration actually doesn't cut government spending. It just reduces the growth in government spending. The entitlements, Social Security, Medicare even faster, and the other ones like Medicaid and so forth, they are offsetting any reduction from sequestration in the growth to government spending.
So when you talk about Medicare and Medicaid, again, there are a lot of arguments being made that we're not attacking the right issues. We're talking about cutting Medicare and Medicaid, but not cutting the expenses, not cutting the cost of pharmaceuticals, not addressing hospital care costs, not addressing costs of insurance, places that kind of that explode the amount of money we spend on Medicare, on health care in America, which is more than any other country in the world, yet for fewer benefits in many ways. And that is the heart of the problem, but that nobody inside of Congress, conservative, liberal, progressive, libertarian, whoever they may be, have the guts or wherewithal to address the real issue.
There have been proposals to reduce the cost of health care, and the only sustainable way of reducing the cost of health care is by introducing more competition in the health care market. The federal government is a major purchaser in the health care market, and with Obamacare, in less than 10 years, the federal government will be the biggest, will take up more than 50% of the whole health care market. And the way that treatments are paid for, as we know, there's a lot of opportunities for cost savings, but because of the way you have a single payer or almost a single payer, there isn't enough competition to bring costs down. And some of the proposals have been, for example, in Medicare, premium support through competition by letting seniors shop in the healthcare market, pick the best insurance plan that works for them. That's one way that you can bring the cost down in a sustainable fashion. Instead, what we've seen is price controls, which we know don't work. Just look at the doc fix. For over 10 years, every year Congress is extending the doc fix, meaning instead of making reductions to payment providers, which is in law, they pass a different law to continue paying physicians at the rate that they did the previous year. So this year, if the doc fix hadn't been extended, physicians would have seen a 20% reduction in what they receive for these healthcare services. This is clearly not sustainable, so of course Congress passes another doc fix, because if you do cut the return on physicians that much, many will not be able to see Medicare patients anymore. So how good are your benefits if you're not able to receive the care that you need? And that is why...
Go ahead. Finish your sentence.
That is why the only sustainable way of controlling costs in healthcare is by introducing more competition through, for example, premium support.
So, again, the other factors in this people look at are that in reality, insurance companies are not regulated, that people's premiums are going up all over the place, that they're not covering what people need in America, and that some people argue that our competition is the exact opposite of what we need, that you need a system that actually controls healthcare costs in America and allows people to have healthcare insurance in a more equitable manner. I mean, so those arguments you argue on both sides, but I think that do you agree or disagree with Ben Bernanke, Federal Reserve Chairman, who I often disagree with on some things, but what he's basically saying is that this sequestration is going to slow the pace of economic growth in America by 1.5% at the very least. That this thing, what's about to happen this week, is a disaster for this economy and a disaster for states. It's a disaster for private companies to do business. It's a disaster for medical research. Any number of things that this is going to affect very drastically.
Sequestration is a very blunt instrument to cut spending, and it doesn't even control the growth in government spending. It only cuts total spending by 2.4%. Much more spending cuts are needed, but they're needed in the right places, and they need to be made in the right way. And, you know, Congress and the president have had over a year to find other spending reductions to offset the cuts from sequestration and make those in areas where we can afford to trim the budget. There's a lot of waste. There's a lot of inappropriate federal spending. And with some deliberation, you can cut federal spending and end up with a stronger economy because you reduce uncertainty from the high deficits and the high debt growth that we're seeing and will continue to see into the future, even with sequestration. And you put the economy on a stronger footing to grow and create jobs. Sequestration, unfortunately, does none of that. The problem is that Washington has not come together on a big budget to cut in those areas where cuts are needed. And so now we're faced with sequestration. But still, sequestration is a minor cut. In fact, in real terms, it doesn't cut government spending, not next year, not into the future. Government spending continues growing. The problem with sequestration is the areas in which it falls, which is 50% on national defense. So you're immediately seeing furloughs in various bases. You're immediately seeing reductions there in terms of base maintenance. And then in all the other areas where it cuts spending by 7 or 8% in a variety of different departments. So I think we can all agree that this is a bad mechanism to cut spending, but we do need to cut spending, and we do need to start somewhere because we are reaching economically damaging debt levels, at which point there will be fewer job creation, there will be less growth in people's salaries and wages. We're looking at higher inflation and higher interest rates in the future, which will slow the economy even more. And that is the real threat
Romina Baccia is an economist, and she is research coordinator for the Rowe Institute for Economic Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation. And Romina Baccia, it's always a pleasure to have you with us. Thanks for joining us once again. I look forward to having you back on the air with us again.
Thank you.
It's time to take a break. We'll be right back. And when we do come back, we'll hear a progressive perspective on this from Nation contributor and editor John Nichols. Don't go away. I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. And now for a progressive perspective on what is going on with austerity and the sequestration and the battles in Congress, we're going to talk to John Nichols. John Nichols is the Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine. He's also a contributing writer for The Progressive magazine and In These Times, and the associate editor of The Capital Times, the daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin. So, John, this is really the whole issue of sequestration, I think, is one that in many ways perplexes the American people. Even the word. I mean, people would say sequestration. Where'd that word come from?
Sequestration is an old term of art in government, right?
Right.
It's one that that has always existed, and it refers to a simple agreement that at a certain point you're going to make cuts, and that those cuts are going to come by advance agreement rather than by, you know, sort of careful calculus of what you're going to do. It's essentially like you've got a date with the hangman, right? There's a certain day at which that you're going to start hacking away at stuff. And, you know, we've done this before. This is not a new concept. It's just that this word has been attached to, kind of a drop-dead date on which a set of cuts that were agreed to long before and that have dramatic impact will go forward unless people decide to pull the brake.
So when you hear, as today, the Republicans talking about we're backing off, we want to give this, throw it just to Barack Obama, the president should come back to us on March the 8th to tell us what cuts he's going to make, and kind of in their way of kind of backing up so they won't get the blame, and throwing it to Obama's court. So I'm curious, what you think about that, but B, the whole issue of $85 billion in cuts, is anyone with any strength and power on Capitol Hill, the White House, saying no, this is not what we need?
Yeah, two very good questions, and going in very different directions. Let's take them apart.
Yeah, take them apart. Yeah, absolutely.
First off, the core concept is this thing really going to happen? You know, on March 1st, at midnight, are some people not going to show up to work at an airport to do TSA screenings or to work in a control tower because there's been a cut? And that is within the realm of possibility that could happen. However, it is easily averted. And it's easily averted in a number of ways, and the Republicans have put one of them forward. And that is to simply say, the president says these are brutal cuts. They shouldn't go through with the Meat Axe approach. So we are giving it to the president saying we rescind sequestration effectively and simply take the part of the agreement that $85 billion is going to be cut. We give that to the president. He's got a couple weeks to figure it out, and we'll be set. Now, the president doesn't agree with that approach for a variety of reasons. First off, he has said that you shouldn't go as deep on cuts. You should have a mix of revenue enhancement, mainly through closing tax loopholes, combined with some, waste, fraud, and abuse cuts. So I'm not sure the Republican plan is going to go forward. It's not even that popular with all the Republicans. There are some Republicans who say, no, we like sequestration. We like this idea. It's time to start cutting. The government can handle $85 billion. So, let's go for it. All right? So that's one model. Another model, which favored by some Democrats, is simply to rescind all of the whole thing. Just say, have Congress vote to get rid of the deal. Say, this is off. We're not doing it. And they could do that with a vote on, Thursday afternoon. That's very, very doable. But there is a real chance that this thing goes forward. And that's important to understand, Mark, because if it goes forward, some people assume that it becomes written in stone. That's the case. You could have sequestration formally on March 1, but on March 5th, Congress could vote for a new resolution that addresses some of the issues. They could address parts of it. They could put in protections for certain agencies. So the bottom line is that this should not be seen as something that's, you know, locked in, that we're on a train and we can't jump off. We can jump off. We can stop the train. The train can go through the station, and then we can stop it at the next station. And once you understand that, I think that's why there's maybe just a tiny bit less tension about sequestration among people who are in the know than there is among some folks who, you know, perhaps are very genuinely concerned, but don't recognize that there's a real chance that even if sequestration goes through on March 1st, it might be dialed back a week later, 2 or 3 days later. So that's your first question, a very good one. The second part of your question is, does anybody object to this? Does anybody just flat out say, stop it, let's not do it? And there's no question. There are many, many members of the House, mostly people in the Congressional Progressive Caucus, folks who you've covered over the years, you know, like Keith Ellison, the congressman from Minnesota, mm-hmm. Co-chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. They developed what they call the Balancing Act. It's a proposal that would mix cuts with revenue enhancements to achieve most of the goals. It's got, you know, reasonable level of support, all the usual progressives. In the Senate, Jeff Merkley, senator from Oregon, has made some very smart proposals regarding this. And so, yeah, there are people who are saying, this is crazy, don't do it. But the biggest group of folks who are saying, don't do it, and that's as opposed to some folks who really do favor it because they think the cuts just have to begin. These are conservatives and some Republicans who really do favor, deep cuts, and they're ready to go. The biggest group of folks, I think, that object to sequestration are not folks who are specifically concerned about sequestration. What they are concerned about is that this is the first step in an austerity progress, that deep cuts will be made, and then they will be made in a sort of a haphazard way, but the proponents of austerity, the proponents of deep cuts, will then come back in very, very quickly afterward and say, okay, now let's have not meat act cuts, but organized austerity with, some specific cutbacks as regards Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, domestic spending, defense spending, things like that. And there are a lot of folks who will tell you that austerity is a very, very bad approach for a country that's struggling to get its economy together. The model, the European austerity model, is one of, by and large, failure, that it, instead of restarting economies, it caused them to stall out even more. And so you do hear, I think, from some smart members of Congress and some smart economists who say sequestration should not go forward because it's sort of the first step in a process of cuts that ultimately could stall out the U.S. economy.
Well, some of the things you've been writing are in direct contradiction to what we heard before you came on the air from when we were talking to Romina Boccaccio, who is an economist with the Heritage Foundation. And
very smart person.
She's a very smart person. Yeah. When we were talking, when you write that America is not broke, and that we don't need to have deep spending cuts in Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. The talk about America not being broke, and also talk about it in terms of, let me take a step back. One of the things we've heard argued is that the Social Security is part of the problem, that Social Security is part of what's dragging us down. There are not enough people to pay into it in a younger generation to pay for all the people of the baby boom generation and beyond who are going to retire. That and when the argument is made, but look, haven't we been raiding the Social Security Trust Fund all these years? Is that the problem? Response becomes, well, that may be the problem, but there's nothing you can do about it, so we have to kind of cut it now to save it later. So let's just start with Social Security for a moment.
Sure. Social Security is an agreement between the American people and their government, and the American people pay in throughout their lifetime, and they earn benefits. Those benefits are to be paid out to them, not merely a return of the money they put in, but a reasonable payment that allows them to stabilize their retirement years so they don't live in poverty. And this agreement has worked through some of the toughest times economically in American history and some of the best times in American history. And those who suggest that Social Security now doesn't work, that somehow you know, everything's different now and the future is darker, are folks who we've had throughout our history. In the 1930s, there were people who said Social Security's not going to work, it's going to bankrupt, it's going to be a horrible thing. 1940s, you had those folks, 1950s, 1960s, people forget that, you know, when Barry Goldwater ran for president in 1964, he had supporters who, you know, raised serious concerns about Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, saying they were just too costly. And so this is not a new discussion. The interesting thing to me is the extent to which we take these people seriously now after they have been proven wrong decade after decade after decade. And the best response to their concern is to say, look, Social Security has constantly been updated and improved. It is a very different program today than it was in the 1930s. And those updates and improvements have often brought new revenue in to assure its long-term viability. What troubles me about people who say that Social Security is broke, that we can't afford it, that we can't let it go forward, is that they refuse to entertain the sort of repairs and improvements, the reforms that we've done in the past to always keep it viable. We should raise the level at which people pay into it so that wealthy people pay into Social Security proportionally in the same way that working people do. And that will yield huge revenues for Social Security. So the bottom line is that when somebody tells you that Social Security is broke, that it doesn't work, that it can't survive, they're really telling you they don't want to do the constant repairs on Social Security, the constant improvements on Social Security that we've done throughout its history. They're a little bit like somebody who says, I've got a car that's running great today. It drives me wherever I want to go, gets good gas mileage, tires are good, the engine's good. It's a really, really good car. But I'm never going to put any oil in it in the future. I'm never going to do any repairs on it in the future. I'm never going to do anything to keep it running as well as it is now. And so this car is broke. This car is ruined. Well, I mean, if that's what they want to believe, that's fine. I don't believe that. I put oil in my car. I do minor repairs so I can keep it on the road. And the same is true about Social Security. Oil in the engine, some minor repairs, it keeps running, period. And anybody who tells you differently is playing a scare tactic, which I think is largely rooted in a long-term disagreement with Social Security. There are people who just don't like that it exists, and they want to find a way to dial it down, to alter it radically, to come up with more privatized systems. That's fine for them to advocate for that. We've always had such folks. We always will. But they should advocate honestly and say they want to stop making improvements to Social Security so that Social Security will cease to exist. If they said that, they would get roughly, 8-10% support from the American people, and the other, 90-92% of the American people would vote to keep Social Security.
One of the arguments you also hear, and we discussed earlier in this program, was that about Medicare, Medicaid, and the cuts of it to entitlements that need to happen. And it seems that, one of the arguments is clearly that the Medicare is being attacked so it can be give seniors and other people's choice, as they say, to pick other plans that in the marketplace, A, and B, that no one's really talking at all about the true cost of health care in America, and that could be the bottom line problem of Medicare. not cutting it, but really addressing the cost, which is beyond Medicare, which is beyond Capitol Hill.
Of course, that's the answer to your question. I mean, to have a Medicare and a Medicaid debate in the abstract, separated out from the broader realities of our healthcare system, is comic. It's sort of like, you know, we're going to talk about the fact that I've got a rash on my arm, and we could treat it, you know, comically. We could put anything on the arm you want, but we're not going to in any way try and figure out what caused it or where, you know, where the broader problem is. Well, you know, maybe the topical treatment will work. Maybe the, you know, the ointment will take the rash away. But if it doesn't, then, you know, I've got a really serious problem. Well, no, I don't have a really serious problem. I just got to look at the sources of the problem and figure out whether I need some medicine, antibiotics or something. That's the reality of where our Medicare and Medicaid systems are at. They are the victims of some very, very bad decisions made, you know, better part of a decade ago. We did a prescription drug plan where we, you know, made prescription drugs more affordable and available to a great many seniors. That was a wonderful thing. But we didn't put cost controls in it. And so, as a result, I mean, it's just through the roof expenses. We didn't put sufficient cost controls in. Similarly, we have all sorts of other challenges in this regard across our country. So what we need to do is reform our healthcare system. We have to be in the process of doing that. We need to give the government the ability to bargain on behalf of great masses of Americans for affordable health care and affordable quality in access to drugs. When we do that, combined with a lot of preventative medicine, we can lower costs in this country, and we can make these programs much more affordable. You know, one of the things that troubles me so greatly is the suggestion that, you know, not with so much with Medicaid, but with Medicare, that an easy fix for it is to say that people can't tap into it until they're above a certain age. You know, we move the age of eligibility up. They do the same thing with Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
That is an incredibly elite approach to this. Because the fact of the matter is that while we do live longer in America, one of the reasons we live longer in America is that our hardest working people are able to retire at a reasonable age and able to get access to quality health care through Medicare at a reasonable age. We don't want to stop that. I mean, we can cut Medicare costs by reducing access to Medicare. We can cut Medicaid costs by reducing access to Medicaid. But we should look at the flip side of that. If we do that, we are saying to people who have worked very, very hard for a very, very long time and are at a point where they need to stop working, but they do need medical care, they can't get it from their job, you know, say, oh, you can't have that. You just got to keep working, you know, at 67, 68. You work in a nursing home. You have to pick patients up who are younger than you, and you have to help them around. Well, that's pretty rough on you at 67, 68. But we're going to deny you the ability to retire and get, you know, health care in retirement so that we can balance the budget here. That is not the closing the circle on what government should be. Government ought to respect the immense contribution that our hardest working Americans make, maintain the programs that they need, and look for ways to lower the costs of those programs that go at the real cost, the profiteering by drug companies, the immense profits of many health insurance companies and healthcare industries think, you know, you can make a decent profit. And I think in a capitalist society, which we have in America, that's going to be accepted. But the idea of making an indecent profit and then saying that Medicare and Medicaid have to be radically altered and limited, I don't think that's a moral choice that we have to make or that we should make.
One of the things I think is important to talk about here that you have raised in your articles, and others have as well at The Nation and other places, about austerity, is this what we're calling this bipartisan commission, Simpson-Bowles, Alan Simpson and Erskine-Bowles. And there were some amazing kind of tape that I heard the other morning. I think you were on the show as well, on Democracy Now.
Yeah.
About what that commission really is and who these men, who are honorable men, but who they really represent. I think that it's fairly shocking to most people because this is being held up as the bipartisan answer that brings liberals, conservatives, Democrats, Republicans together to understand why austerity is necessary.
Yeah, there's, you know, look, the biggest mistake in looking at the austerity debate in the U.S. or internationally is to think of this in partisan terms. The fact of the matter is that if you look at Europe, you will find that social democratic parties on the left have implemented austerity and conservative parties on the right have implemented austerity. Austerity is not an ideological initiative. It may be an ideology unto itself, you know, that there are people who just believe this is the way to do it, but it's an economic ideology, not a political one. So you see right-wingers and left-wingers, Democrats and Republicans, who embrace the austerity model because they think that either innocently, they believe that it will fix the problem, that if you simply stop spending, everything's going to be okay. And that model is like in your family, if you're paying for your kids to go to college and you get a little bit of a setback, you just stop doing it, right? You don't take loans, you balance your books, and then so your kids don't go to college. Your kids don't do, whatever else you might be paying for because you don't have the money to do it. That's the austerity model. The growth model, which is the alternative to that, says, no, that's never worked any place in the world. It's not going to work here. The better solution is a mix of, responsible cuts where they can be achieved in, waste, fraud, and abuse, but also investment, trying to grow an economy that then puts resources back in, not to stall the economy out, but to get it going. And I think that you are going to find Democrats and Republicans who buy into austerity, you're going to find Democrats and Republicans who buy into growth coming from different perspectives. The troubling thing to me in the current debate is neither of those groupings. I accept people who sincerely believe in austerity. I disagree with them. And I certainly accept and agree with people who believe in a growth model. What I find unacceptable, what we wrote about a good deal in The Nation, is folks who appear to be trying to game the system at this point, trying to take advantage of it. And that's what we saw in so many of the models put forward by Simpson and Bowles. They propose, as well as Fix the Debt Coalition they're involved with, funded mainly by very wealthy CEOs. They favor cuts to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. They put them in nice terms. They say they love those programs, but they're going to change CPI, which is going to take away cost of living increases. That is a cut, there's no doubt. They suggest an openness toward raising eligibility ages, things of that nature. So those are threats of cuts. At the same time, they say they want to reduce the top marginal rate for wealthy taxpayers and corporations. And I'm like, wow, if we're in a situation, if we're at a point in this country where we have to take from senior citizens, we have to say to somebody who's worked, 62, 65 years, you're going to have to work till you're 70 or, 71 before you can access your earned benefits in the future. If we say to somebody who's already retired, no, you're not getting cost of living increases in the quality or the character you did in the past, so you're going to have less. If we're at that point, shouldn't we say to our billionaires and our corporations, well, you need to take a cut as well. You need to pay higher taxes, not lower taxes. Well, that's not what Simpson and Bowles and the Fix the Debt folks are saying. And so the argument that I make is that these folks appear to be trying to game the system. They appear to be trying to argue that we're in a crisis situation, a crisis moment, and we have to make radical changes. But it happens, those radical changes benefit them while they hurt the rest of us. And Americans should be aware of that reality. They shouldn't simply accept what Simpson and Bowles proposed, what the Fix the Debt Coalition proposes, because these folks are bipartisan. There's nothing about bipartisanship that makes makes their proposals, right? And there's nothing about bipartisanship that exempts them from scrutiny by those of us who want to make sure that, that we're not being sold a bill of goods by wealthy folks who just want to practice what Naomi Klein refers to as disaster capitalism, a sort of a shock doctrine in economics, this idea that we would say our economic circumstance is so dire, so horrible, that we've got to do deep cuts, very painful to working people, but at the same time, tax breaks for very wealthy folks. That's a bad combination, and I just, you know, I can't embrace it.
John Nichols, who is Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine, he's also a contributing writer for The Progressive and In These Times, and the associate editor of The Capital Times, which is the daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin, which is his home. And John Nichols, thank you once again for joining us.
It is a pure pleasure. I love this show.
Thank you. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Bobby Marvin Holmes, Stephanie Mavronis, and Mark Gunnery. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. For WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.